The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Battered by inflation, haunted by fears of depression, and confronted with the prospect of vast redistributions of national resources, the nations of the world are presently in terrible trouble. Everywhere you look, you see symbols, signs, obvious trends and conditions that show we are headed toward a time of international, global disequilibrium. Of the breakup of old power blocks and alliances, witness NATO and the problem of those two NATO partners of Greece and Turkey. Of the realignment of other nations, the unbelievable fluctuation of the world monetary system of all major currencies floating, trying to find their own way in a wildly gyrating market. Governments toppling around the world. Drought and famine hitting at the very same time. Labor unrest in Britain. The scramble for mid-east oil and four times higher price rises there. Hunger in India and the sub-African or the Sahara Belt in Africa. All of these are straining to the breaking point. The close ties that have built up among nations of the world since World War II. Since World War II, this world has made a fair amount of progress in certain directions. The richer have gotten richer and richer, and the poorer have gotten poorer and poorer. Détente is progress of a sort. Nuclear arms limitations in the face of more than 40 nations operating their own nuclear reactors, I suppose some people could call progress of a sort. At least some kind of a warming up or a slowdown of the Cold War is progress of a sort. And yet at the same time, this world voraciously devouring the non-renewable life support systems of this thin envelope of the ecosphere on which we live has gone on apace so that in the time since the close of World War II, we have gobbled up more of Earth's resources than all of humankind managed to do up to and including that time. Inflation is almost everywhere. Slowdown, retrenchment, change, fluctuation, heads of state traveling back and forth as never before, governments toppling as never before. Are we dealing then with vast, universal, global conditions on this little speck of life of ours out here in the midst of the blackness of the universe, or are we dealing with just isolated local or county or state areas where farmers are either lucky or unlucky if they lose half or most of their crops? Are we dealing with the headaches of housewives who notice that the price of sugar or beans is going up again? Are we dealing with the curses and the problems of truck drivers and private citizens driving trucks or automobiles who notice the terrible price of diesel fuel or gasoline? Or are we dealing with something far more ominous than all that, far more important than people's individual or private problems? We live on a round earth out in the vastness of this universe, in our own corner of the Milky Way that is comparable to one grain of sand in all of the seemingly endless seashores of all of the earth. That's about the comparison of the number of grains of sand there are. In the galaxies out here, there are literally billions, perhaps, of galaxies and up to 200 billion, billion stars in one of those. And each star, remember, is like our sun, except most of them are bigger. Our sun is an orange dwarf, they call it, one of the very small stars. Some of the other ones are so large that if moved into the position of our sun, such as one of the large stars in the so-called constellation of Orion, that it would totally absorb the Earth and Mars and Venus. That's how big that one star would be in its mass or its volume. So we, in our little spaceship, our little speck of life on this earth of ours in its seemingly endless and monotonous journey, sometimes look only right at our feet, right in our own immediate environment, at our around. We look at our apartment or our home, our job, our farm, our planned vacation, our family, our own personal pursuits. It's so difficult to get our minds expanded. We seek for mind-bending, mind-expanding, or even escapism experiences out of the bottom of a bottle, or maybe a tube of glue, or maybe a Benny or a Red or a Yellow, or maybe mainlining it, trying to escape some of the pressures and the shock. It's called Future Shock in one book you might avail yourself of sometime. And people simply have forgotten how to cope. Our problems, our own individual personal health problems and financial problems, are so gigantic in our own sight that we cannot see the universal situation of this spaceship of ours. And if we could, maybe all of humankind would be living differently. Maybe we would be getting about the business of solving some of the incredibly complex and mind-defying problems that are beyond human solution or even human definition, if we could just get the overview. Well, supposing they are wrong. What if they are wrong? What if God is not dead after all? What if there is a God? And what if there were some way you could prove it, even intellectually, so to speak, even in a mechanical, educational process by simply weighing certain choices and deciding which is the most intelligent? What if you could take a look at evolution and discover whether or not evolution has a leg to stand on? What if you could find out for yourself whether or not there is any rational way to explain the totality of this vast and awesome universe of ours, the forces, the energies that act upon it, that make it what it is? Why, when you think of the fact that inside the towering cumulonimbus thunderstorms that go up 40, 50,000 feet that you see dumping deluges of rain and sometimes touching tornadoes down and tearing up the landscape and even destroying property and homes and taking human life. And when you realize that in just one of those fluffies, you see it from over there about a couple of hundred miles away, maybe the sun has already set where you are and that thing is towering over there to the east and it looks so good, it looks so beautiful, like a big old bowl of mashed potatoes, doesn't it? But underneath that thing, somebody is getting hurt, the chances are, because do you know that inside one of those big towering thunderstorms you see in the summer is unleashed more power than several multi-megaton nuclear bombs. I mean, in seconds, that thing is unleashing more energy in just a summer thunderstorm than dozens of nuclear bombs are unleashing. But when you stop to think that it takes an atomic bomb of the size that completely devastated Hiroshima to be the match that ignites a nuclear bomb, and I mean by that, of course, a hydrogen bomb, a nuclear type that is called hydrogen, uses the principle of fusion instead of fission. It takes fissionable material to create a fusionable explosion in a hydrogen bomb. And so, actually, the best way for me to say it is that man has discovered a key by which, through nuclear fission and fusion, he is able to unlock just a little tiny bit of the stored energy and the power that is somehow compacted into this universe and our own Earth. Now, if you back off from that big 50,000-foot thunderstorm and you look at the picture of the satellite, it's an indiscernible little blob in the swirls of white clouds that cover the Earth, and every single day now, with far better weather reporting because of stationary and orbital satellites all around the world, up there hundreds of miles sometimes away, clicking pictures several times a minute, we can continually have even television reports of exactly the way those swirling lows and highs, and the way they go in the northern hemisphere at least, counterclockwise around a low pressure area, and the opposite direction in the southern hemisphere, much like water flowing down the sink or the bathtub when you pull the cork. And so we can understand, and we realize that all those things act in a certain definable way. There seem to be laws that measure and that control and that guarantee a certain action of the flowing of ocean currents and the flowing of warm and cold air masses, the rising of hot air and the sinking to the earth of cooler air, and that regulate pressure and temperature, and that create unstable or stable weather conditions that cause the weather, and that cause the rain, and that cause the drought on this earth of ours. As you back off still further out toward the sun, and the earth begins to look smaller and smaller, as we have been privileged in this day and age to sit in front of our television sets and actually see pictures of Earthrise over the horizon of the moon. It gives us a kind of a mental perspective that is completely different, and it's interesting. Maybe it's not so interesting as it is tragic to look into the lives of those men who have gone to the moon and to see the profound psychological, perhaps you could call it spiritual, maybe you could say mental, changes that have taken place in their lives as a result. It must be shocking not just to sit in the comfort of your home or your automobile listening to me talk about it and thinking about it together, but actually to go there and to see and to experience with every pore in your body the fact that you are a tiny little ant-like creature grubbing around on the surface of one little isolated greenhouse, one little speck of life in the vastness of nothing. It must do something to the mind. There's a book out or some magazine articles about what it has done to the minds of men who have been there. I haven't read it yet. I understand it makes very interesting reading. And so what if they're wrong? What if there is a God out there? What if there is a great being that had the power to do all of that, that had the power to build those stars and to set in motion those laws? How can you explain creation without a creator and law without a lawgiver? And life without previous, pre-existing life, and life of the same kind? And how can you sustain or operate or keep these laws in motion? How do they keep going? Why do they operate in an orderly fashion? Why not just through haphazard randomness? Why do you see invention, creativity, and design when you look closely into the physical properties of matter and the laws that govern energy and light and space and heat and motion? Why do you see intricacy and design? Why not haphazardness and randomness? The closer you look at that which is so-called natural, such as the cleavage properties of minerals or the grain of sand I spoke of, or perhaps even foodstuffs and fibers or cellular or molecular structure of living things, the more flawless perfection, the more incredible beauty, the more interaction, interdependability, and harmony. And the closer you look at that which man does, the more flaws and the more imperfection. From a distance, to use the analogy of a painting, your eye tells you there are lots of things there that aren't there at all. And up a little closer, you begin to see that your eye created a lot of things. There is a certain surrealism in that sense in any kind of a painting, including landscapes or portraits. And the closer you get, the more imperfection you see. That's because of the kind of a trick your own eye plays on you because of distance. You might talk about beautiful photography, but if you were to get a microscope, you would find that all photography is reproduced in printing presses and coming to you in some of the slick magazines are done by a series of little dots. They're all little round dots, and you can greatly magnify them, and there's a great deal of empty space between them. And it's just a placement of little dots. It's quite a process. The closer you look, the more flaws and imperfection you see. The closer you look at that which God has created, the more perfection and the more beauty. Are we really living then in a time of crisis where the narrow envelope on our ecosphere that is just about exactly as thick as the lacquer on a desk-sized globe? That's the narrow envelope of life in which we live. Are we living in a time of human crisis, a time of shortages of Earth's resources, of impending disasters beyond human ability to even comprehend or describe, let alone to solve? Well, you've heard, of course, about inflation, because certainly if you haven't heard about it, you've been living in a cave somewhere. You've heard about change. You've heard about international monetary problems. You've heard about perhaps the Herrstadt Bank over in West Germany going down the drain, about the difficulties with Franklin, about the unbelievable problems of country after country going hat in hand begging to other countries, about the ignominy of proud Britain having to go to the Iranian government to beg billions, of the United States having to go to the Arabs and ask if they wouldn't like to invest in good old USA security. Oh, sure, you've heard of all of that. And we've heard about shortages of oil. And we've heard about shortages of other things. But have you heard about some of the most ominous shortages of all? Not just of oil, but even as water, of timber, of uranium, copper, silver, tin, nickel, lumber, and especially farmland. We don't seem to realize that all of humankind is not equally distributed around the world, that most of the world is inhospitable for human life. In the first place, much of that globe of ours is covered by water. It's mostly oceans. And I don't care what we think about cities under the sea or people growing gills or people surviving with aqua lungs or anything of the kind. That's a bunch of bush twaddle and fish daw, and there's no way for you to sit around and listen to some dumb scientist who is so cloistered and ivory-towered that he is an impractical dreamer to tell you about the way mankind is suddenly going to farm the seas, or he's going to live under the ocean, or he's going to equally distribute himself around in a different pattern than he is presently. No, it won't work. Forget it. Now, secondly, most of the land mass is uninhabitable. A case in point is Australia, where over half the population lives in just about three cities. Another case in point is Canada, where most of the population lives in a fairly narrow area right along the American border, in the Plain States and along the southern reaches, but where the Northwest Territories and the gigantic reaches of the Yukon and some of those areas are some of the least densely populated of any area in the world simply because of their absolute inhospitality for human life. Oh, they're great for ducks and mosquitoes, but human beings just can't live there very well. You can look at the vastness of the Amazon basin and the same comment. Very few people living in that area. Most of this earth is either too high, it's too steep, it is too rocky, it's too low, it's too sandy, it is too wet, or it's too dry. Think about it. I've already said that most of the earth is oceans, and it's true. But most of the rest of the earth is inhospitable for human habitation for a variety of other reasons. Now, global trends and conditions are that less and less of the earth is becoming hospitable for human inhabitation. That the drought areas or the desert areas of the world are growing very, very rapidly. Meanwhile, some of the very large food grain producers, and the four major ones are Argentina, the United States, the Soviet Union, and Canada, they are taking millions upon millions of acres out of production every year, which will never be put back into production simply because we're covering it up with concrete, steel, and asphalt. Within the next decade, it is projected that in the desires of many countries to gradually gear up toward the production of electrical energy by nuclear reactors, that the demand for uranium is going to outrun available supplies. That's in the next decade. So that's the very immediate future. That's before the 2000s. Known reserves of minerals are expected to be very severely depleted by the 2000s, the 1990s that people talk about, and scientists project forward talking about the glittering, wonderful world that we're going to live in by that time, with everybody with his own private helicopter like as not, and own private aircraft where he can go back and forth around the world as he pleases, and then jump into his smogmobile, which will get him to where he wants to go inside his city by radar, because he won't be able to see. Because by that time, the production of energy by the burning of fossil fuels and so on will have so polluted the earth, we'll just about have to try to live under the sea, because the earth will be uninhabitable, and large percentages of it are becoming that way because of man's pollution anyway. Probably you didn't know that by 1980, the United States may be facing a fresh water shortage of up to 100 billion gallons a day. Now, the last time I looked, this was 1974. So by 1980 is not an awful long time away. Already, we know that many areas are having to use recycled water. Maybe they don't think of it every day as they go to the restaurant and they pour the water in a glass. We do that in the United States, unlike other countries where you have to ask for it, and if you get it, it's in a bottle. We're still accustomed to this kind of a thin chemical soup of dead amoebic dysentery bacteria that is fed on something else along the way somewhere, the kind of a soup, you know, of inhospitable liquid in which nothing can live, which we call water. Now, whether or not it's really water is maybe open for question, unless you investigate and find exactly what is that stuff and what is in it, how many chemicals, and what it's going to do to you. Demands for lumber in the United States for building and construction are expected to increase by 57% in the next 30 years. And when you take a look at some of the lumbering areas of this world of ours, and especially the northwest of the United States, other big lumbering states, it looks like they've already got about half of it gone. I mean, from 39,000 feet over Oregon and Washington, it looks like the two-state area has got the chicken pox. That's because vast areas of the Cascade Mountains have been cut, where there are huge, many-acre tracts that have been absolutely stripped. Now, of course, they're planting. That's great. But trees like that take 20, 30, 50, and more years to grow. They don't grow in just a few years. So we're talking of the increase in 30 years by 57% in demand. That's everything we're doing now, and over half again as much. Meantime, they tell you that American hardwoods have all but died out. The hardwoods for furniture are virtually non-existent. That American walnut is all but totally gone. They're even shifting over to different types of wood, for example. Of course, going to veneers and solid woods are virtually a thing of the past, but shifting over to different kinds of woods for furniture and for fine wood simply because of a terrible shortage in the United States and because of a trend both of weather, where these older and bigger trees are dying, and of timber methods. So the softer woods are pretty much in vogue for furnitures, and of course, synthetics, and a lot of that comes from petrochemicals as well as other sources. And we understand that pulpwood is in terrible shortages, and of course, pulpwood workers want more money, so they've been on strike, and newsprint is out of sight, but also it's becoming terribly short. So some of the major newspapers of the country are going straight down the drain simply because of rising costs and lack of adequate revenues to write off those costs. They just can't keep going. Now, we're taking thousands of acres a day out of production as we build freeways and highways and byways and off-ramps, and as we build subdivisions, and as our super megalopolises, cancer-like, willy-nilly, sprawl outward into the environment where some of the best farmland in the United States is, and some of the greatest farmland in our country right now is under the asphalt and the concrete and the homes by the millions all around the United States, and yet it's going to take 10 to 40 million acres of new farmland each year to maintain the current level of malnutrition in the world. I better say that again. It's a scientific fact that it's going to take somewhere between 10 to 40 million acres of new farmland put into production over and above what we've got, not talking about that unbelievable loss every single day and every week, just to maintain the current level, which is a level that isn't adequate, but a level of malnutrition in the world. So the shortages in the narrow ecosphere, the biosphere of this earth of ours, out here in the blackness of the universe, are real. And they are everywhere. And these are shortages that are not necessarily going to be solved by political change, by a military government or martial law, or just by discovering new sources of energy or something of this nature. We're talking about measurable quantities that are on this earth and do exist. And there is only so much tin. And there is only so much copper and so much nickel and so much chromium and so much silver. Then there is no more. And we are using these things at an unbelievable, prodigious rate. Worldwide, we are now entering a time that is so absolutely vividly like the time Jesus Christ of Nazareth talked of in Matthew 24 that it's unescapable. You just cannot get around it. He talked of a time of global, national upsets of wars and rumors of wars, and he talked of a time of drought and famine, talking of a time of pestilence, meaning the combination of insect and animal infestation, and disease. And every magazine you pick up that shows you the unbelievable problems of much of this world millions starving now, on a starvation level now. Wars and rumors of wars are certainly here and there everywhere. And right at the very time when the United States farmers were taking additional millions of acres out of soil bank, looking toward a great bumper year, along came exactly what I was predicting would occur before live audiences of tens of thousands all around the United States and Canada. Drought in 1974. Now, one doctor who is very prominent in that field of agriculture was saying, if we are lucky next year, we'll probably come out all right, but if we're unlucky, it will be an absolute disaster. I was very appreciative of the interview, but I had to disagree with him about whether or not it is a matter of luck. Because, you see, there are biblical prophecies that show that it has nothing to do with luck, that it has something to do with whether or not the nation that is suffering these problems will turn to God and will literally get on its knees and pray to that God and obey God's laws that govern even the weather, or whether they will think it's a matter of luck, of cycles, of happenstance. Over in the fifth chapter of the book of Isaiah, there is a prophecy that has to do with a kind of a song to a person that was a husbandman of a vineyard. It says that there was a vineyard in a very fruitful hill that was fenced, and the stones were gathered out, and the nice walls were built, and it produced the choicest vine. But when the owner came, he looked, and instead of grapes, they were all wild and grown over the rocky walls. The walls were broken down, there were weeds everywhere, and it was a wretched mess. And it begins in that fifth chapter to say, well, what could have been more done to that vineyard than I have done? And God answers and likens it unto the nation, saying, the vineyard of the Eternal of Hosts is the house of Israel. And then he said, he looked for judgment, but behold, oppression. For righteousness, but behold, a scream or a cry. And like as not the wail of sirens and crying. He looked for right things, good things, equitable, fair, just, and honorable things. But instead he saw sin and crime and slop and swill and filth, vanity, greed, lust, jealousy. He said in verse 8 of that chapter, woe unto them that join house to house, that lay field to field, till there be no place. Isn't that interesting? And look what we're doing today. He went on to say, of the truth, many houses shall be desolate, even great and fair, without inhabitant. 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath. That is an old Hebrew measurement that means 8 gallons. Now, I'm not a wine grower, but it seems to me like 10 solid acres of grapes that yield up 8 gallons of grape juice is a pretty pitiful harvest. And the seed of an omer shall yield an ephah, and those are terribly disparate measurements. He is showing a time of drought and a famine and saying his people do not consider the operation of the hand of the Eternal. He cites drunkenness. He cites those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness and bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And he says we're going to pay the piper. You ought to write for the book that I've been announcing this past series of broadcasts on Is This the End Time? And all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.